beginning on chapter 13, The Value of Life, Pessimism and Optimism. A counterpart to the question of life's purpose or vocation is that of life's value. In relation to this question, we encounter two opposed views, together with every conceivable attempt at compromise between them. One view says that this world is the best that could conceivably exist, and that life and action in it are gifts of inestimable value. Everything exhibits harmonious and purposeful cooperation, and everything is worthy of admiration. Even what is apparently bad and evil may be recognized as good from a higher standpoint. It represents a beneficial counterpart to what is good. We value the good all the more for its contrast with evil. Nor is evil something truly real. We merely sense as evil what is a lesser degree of good. Evil is the absence of good, not something significant in itself. The other view claims that life is full of trial and tribulation. Everywhere unpleasure outweighs pleasure, pain outweighs joy, existence is a burden, and in all circumstances non-existence would be preferable to existence. The main proponents of the first view, optimism, are Shaftesbury and Leibniz. Of the second view, pessimism, the main proponents are Schopenhauer and Edward von Hartmann. Leibniz believes this is the best of all possible worlds. A better one is impossible, for God is good and wise. A good God wants to create the best of all worlds. A wise God knows what is best. Such a God can distinguish best from all other, worse, possibilities. Only an evil or unwise God could create a world worse than the best possible. Anyone who starts from this viewpoint finds it easy to prescribe the direction that human activity must take to contribute its share to the greatest good of the world. A human being must only discover the counsels of God and act accordingly. If we know what God intends for the world and the human race, then we shall also do what is right. And we will gladly add our own good to the good of the world. From the optimistic standpoint, then, life is worth living. It must stimulate us to cooperative participation. Schopenhauer pictures the matter differently. He thinks of the ground of the universe not as an all-wise and all-good being, but as blind drive or will. The fundamental trait of all willing is eternal striving, ceaseless yearning for satisfaction that can, however, never be attained. For as soon as we attain the goal of our striving, a new need arises, and so on. Satisfaction lasts less than an instant. The whole remaining content of our life is unsatisfied craving, that is, dissatisfaction, suffering. If our blind urge is finally dulled, then we become contentless, and infinite boredom fills our existence. Therefore, the best course is to stifle wishes and needs, to extirpate our wanting. Schopenhauer's pessimism leads to inactivity. His ethical goal is universal sloth. By a fundamentally different method, von Hartmann tries to found pessimism and then use it for ethics. Following a favored tendency of our time, von Hartmann attempts to found his worldview on experience. From observation of life, he seeks to discover whether pleasure or pain predominates in the world. Reviewing everything that appears good or fortunate to us in the light of reason, he shows that all supposed contentment proves on closer inspection to be illusion. It is illusory to believe that we have sources of happiness and satisfaction in health, youth, freedom, adequate income, love, sexual pleasure, compassion, friendship and family life, self-esteem, honor, fame, power, religious education, pursuit of science and art, hope of life hereafter, or participation in cultural evolution. Soberly considered, every pleasure brings much more evil and suffering into the world than pleasure. The displeasure of a hangover is always greater than the pleasure of intoxication. Pain predominates in the world. No human being, not even the relatively happiest, would, if asked, choose to endure this miserable life a second time. And yet, since von Hartmann does not deny the presence of conceptuality, wisdom, in the world, but rather accords it a validity equal to blind urge or will, he can attribute the world's creation to his primordial being, only if he can make the pain of the world serve a wise world purpose. The pain of the world's creatures, however, is none other than God's pain. for the life of the world as a whole is identical with the life of God. An all-wise being, however, can only have as its goal liberation from suffering, and since all existence is suffering, that means liberation from existence. Thus the aim of world creation is to carry being over into a far better state of non-being. The world process is a continual struggle against God's pain and ends finally in annihilation of all existence. Hence human morality is participation in the annihilation of existence. God created the world to free himself through the world from his infinite pain. According to von Hartmann, that pain must, quote, be considered in a certain way as an itching rash on the absolute, unquote. Through this itching eruption, the unconscious healing power of the absolute frees itself from an inner illness, or else we must think of it, quote, as a painful poultice that the all-one being applies to itself in order first to draw an inner pain outward and then remove it altogether, unquote. Human beings are integral members of the world. God suffers in them. He created them to disperse his infinite pain. The pain that each one of us suffers is only a drop in the infinite ocean of God's pain. Human beings must steep themselves in the awareness that the quest for individual satisfaction, egoism, is foolish. All they need to do is dedicate themselves through selfless devotion to the world process, the redemption of God. Thus, in contrast to Schopenhauer's pessimism, Hartmann's pessimism leads to devoted activity in a lofty task. But what about the claim that this view is based on experience? To strive for satisfaction is to reach in one's life activity beyond life's... Let me read that again. To strive for satisfaction is to reach in one's life activity beyond life's given content. A creature is hungry, that is, when the furtherance of its organic functions requires new life content in the form of nourishment, it strives to be filled. To strive for honor means to regard one's personal actions and omissions as valuable only when they are recognized from without. The striving for knowledge arises when, before we have understood it, something seems missing from the world we see, hear, and so on. Fulfillment of striving creates pleasure in the striving individual. Lack of fulfillment creates pain. It is important to note here that pleasure or pain depend only on the fulfillment or non-fulfillment of striving. Striving itself can in no way count as pain. If it turns out that in the moment one's striving is fulfilled, a new striving immediately appears. I cannot say for me, pleasure has given birth to pain, because enjoyment always creates a desire for its repetition or for new pleasure. I can speak of pain only when this desire hits up against the impossibility of its fulfillment. Even when an enjoyment that I have experienced creates a longing for a greater or more refined experience of pleasure, I can speak of it as pain created by the earlier pleasure only if I lack the means to experience that greater or more refined pleasure. Only when pain appears as a natural consequence of enjoyment, as when a woman's sexual pleasure is followed by the suffering of childbirth and the cares of child-rearing, can I consider enjoyment the creator of pain. If striving by itself evoked pain, then every reduction of striving should be accompanied by pleasure. But the opposite is the case. A lack of striving in our lives produces boredom, which is connected with displeasure. Since striving can, in the nature of things, last a long time before receiving any fulfillment, and since for the moment it remains content with that hope, it must be acknowledged that pain has nothing to do with striving as such, but depends merely on its non-fulfillment. Schopenhauer then is certainly wrong when he holds desire or striving in itself, the will, to be the source of pain. In reality, it is just the reverse. Striving, desiring, as such, brings joy. Who does not know the enjoyment offered by hope of a goal that is distant but intensely desired? This joy is the companion of work whose fruits will come our way only in the future. Such pleasure is quite independent of attaining our goal. If this goal is finally attained, the pleasure of fulfillment is then added as something new to the pleasure of striving. But if anyone claims that the pain of disappointed hope adds to the pain of an unattained goal, and makes the pain of unfulfillment greater in the end than the pleasure there might have been in the fulfillment, we would have to reply that the opposite can also occur. The recollection of pleasure will just as often have a mitigating effect on the pain of unfulfillment. Anyone who cries out in the face of shattered hopes, quote, "I have done all that I could," unquote, is proof of this. The blissful sense of having tried to do one's best is overlooked by those who, with every unfulfilled desire, assert that not only is the joy of fulfillment absent, but even the enjoyment of desiring itself is destroyed. Fulfillment of desire evokes pleasure, and non-fulfillment evokes pain. But we must not conclude from this that pleasure is satisfaction of desire, and pain is its non-satisfaction. Both pleasure and pain can be present in someone without being a consequence of desire. Illness is pain that is not preceded by desire. Anyone claiming that illness is an unsatisfied desire for health errs in seeing the obvious wish not to become sick, a wish that is never brought into awareness as a positive desire. If we inherit a legacy from a rich relative of whose existence we had no notion, it fills us with a pleasure that had no preceding desire. Those who wish to investigate whether there is an excess on the side of pleasure or pain must take into account the pleasure of desiring, the pleasure of the fulfillment of desire, and the pleasure that comes to us without effort. On the other side of the ledger, they must put the displeasure of boredom, that of unfulfilled striving, and finally what encounters us apart from our desires. To this column belongs the pain caused by work imposed upon us that we have not chosen for ourselves. The question now arises, what is the right method for reckoning the balance of these credits and debits? Edward von Hartmann believes that it is reason that weighs them. To be sure, he also says, quote, "pain and pleasure exist only to the extent that they are felt," unquote. It follows from this that there is no other yardstick for pleasure than the subjective one of feeling. I must feel whether the sum of my pleasurable and unpleasurable emotions results in a balance of joy or pain within me. Regardless of this, von Hartmann claims, quote, "though the value of every creature's life can be found only by looking at its own subjective yardstick, this is not to say that every creature calculates the total emotional contents of life correctly, or, in other words, that its total estimate of its own life is correct with regard to its subjective experiences," unquote. Thereby rational judgment about feeling is made once more into the proper evaluator. Footnote, anyone who wants to calculate whether the sum total of pleasure or of pain predominates forgets that that a calculation is being set up about something that is never experienced. Feeling does not calculate, and for the real evaluation of life, what matters is real experience, not the result of an imaginary calculation. End of footnote. Those who adhere more or less exactly to the views of such thinkers as Edward von Hartmann might believe that to evaluate life properly, they have to clear away the factors that falsify our judgment about the balance of pleasure and pain. There are two ways that they can try to do this. First, they can show that our desire, drive, or will interferes negatively with a sober evaluation of our feelings. For example, while we ought to realize that sexual enjoyment is a source of troubles, the power of the sexual drive seduces us, promising greater pleasure than it delivers. We want the enjoyment, and so do not admit to ourselves that it makes us suffer. Second, adherents of this view can submit feelings to a critique and try to demonstrate in the light of reason that the objects to which our feelings attach are illusory, and that they are destroyed as soon as our ever-growing intelligence sees through the illusions. In other words, they can consider the question in the following way. If an ambitious man, for instance, wants to know whether pleasure or pain has played the greater part in his life thus far, he must free himself from two sources of error in judgment. Since he is ambitious, this fundamental character trait will make him magnify the joys over the recognition of his achievements and diminish the humiliations caused by his setbacks. But when he actually experienced the setbacks, he felt the humiliations deeply, precisely because he is ambitious. In memory, however, these setbacks appear in a milder light, while the joys of recognition to which he is so susceptible engrave themselves all the deeper, Certainly for the ambitious man, it is a real benefit that this should be so. Illusion diminishes his displeasure in the moment of self-observation, yet his judgment is false. The sufferings over which a veil is drawn for him had to be really experienced in all their strength, and so he actually enters them incorrectly on his life's balance sheet. To arrive at a proper judgment, the ambitious man would have to rid himself of his ambition at the moment of contemplation. He would have to review his life with no colored glass before his spiritual eyes. Otherwise he is like a merchant who enters his own business zeal in the credit column. Holders of this view can go still further, however. They can say that the ambitious man must also realize that the recognition for which he strives is worthless. Either on his own or with the help of others, he can realize that recognition by others can have no importance for a rational person. After all, we can always be sure that, quote, the majority is wrong and the minority is right in all such matters that are not fundamental questions of evolution or have not already been completely solved by science, unquote, so that, quote, whoever makes ambition his guiding star places his happiness in life at the service of such a judgment, unquote. 6. Philosophie des Unbewussten. I believe that's by Hartmann. In footnote. If the ambitious man can say all this to himself, then he must characterize as illusion what his ambition pictured as reality. And therefore he must also characterize as illusion the feelings that attach to these illusions. On this basis, it may be said that the feelings of pleasure resulting from illusion must also be stricken from the balance. What is left, then, represents the illusion-free sum of pleasure. And this is so small in comparison with the sum of pain that life is joyless and non-being is preferable to being. But while it is immediately obvious that the interference of ambition deceives us into false calculations concerning pleasure, what has been said about recognizing the illusory character of pleasure's objects must still be challenged. It would be an error to remove from the calculation of life's pleasure all feelings of pleasure attached to real or supposed illusions. For the ambitious man has really enjoyed the admiration of the masses, regardless of whether he himself or someone else later recognizes this admiration as illusory. This process does not in the least diminish the feeling of pleasure that was enjoyed. Elimination of all such illusory feelings from life's balance does not set right our judgment about feelings, but rather erases from life feelings that were all really present. And why should those feelings be eliminated? Whoever has these feelings experiences pleasure through them. Whoever has conquered them experiences through that conquest, not through feeling in a self-satisfied way, quote, what a wonderful person I am, unquote, but through the objective sources of pleasure that lie within the conquest itself, a pleasure that is spiritualized, to be sure, but no less significant. If feelings are struck from the pleasure column because they attach to objects that turn out to be illusory, then the value of life is made dependent on not the quantity, but the quality of pleasure, and that in turn is made dependent on the value of the things that cause the pleasure. However, if I want to determine the value of life only from the quantity of pleasure or pain, then I must not presuppose something else by which I first determine the value or valuelessness of the pleasure. If I say, quote, I want to compare the quantity of pleasure with the quantity of pain to see which is greater, unquote, then I must also bring into the calculation all pleasure and pain in their actual amounts, quite apart from whether they are based on illusion or not. Anyone who ascribes less life value to a pleasure based on illusion than to one that is justifiable by reason is making the value of life dependent on factors other than pleasure. The person who estimates pleasure at a lower rate because it attaches to a worthless object is like a merchant who enters in his ledger the considerable profits of a toy factory at a quarter of their worth on the grounds that the factory produces mere playthings for children. If it is merely a question of weighing the relative quantities of pleasure and pain, then the illusory character of the objects of certain feelings of pleasure should be left completely out of the picture. With its reasoned consideration of the quantities of pleasure and pain created by life, the path recommended by von Hartmann therefore brings us to this point. We know how we are to set up our accounts. We know what we have to place on each side of our ledger, But how should the calculation now be made? Is reason, in fact, equipped to reckon the balance? If the calculated profit does not equal a business's demonstrable past profits or future gains, then the merchant has made an error. The philosopher, too, will certainly have made an error of assessment if it is impossible to demonstrate that a cleverly calculated surplus of pleasure or pain is actually felt. For the moment, I shall not review the calculations of the pessimists, who support their opinions with a rationalist worldview. Still, anyone deciding whether or not to carry on with the business of life will first demand to be shown where the calculated surplus of pain is to be found. Here we touch the point where reason by itself is not in a position to determine the surplus of pleasure or pain, but must rather demonstrate that surplus as a percept in life. For human beings cannot attain reality solely through concepts, but only through the interpenetration, mediated by thinking, of concepts and percepts, and feelings are percepts. A merchant, likewise, will close his business only if the loss calculated by his accountant is confirmed by the facts. If that does not happen, he will have the accountant calculate again. We conduct the business of life in just the same way. If a philosopher wants to prove that pain is much more common than pleasure, and yet we do not feel this to be so, then we say, you have made a mistake in your brooding. Think it through again. But if at a given moment a business really suffers such losses that its credit can no longer satisfy the creditors, then bankruptcy results even if the merchant's bookkeeping obscures the state of his affairs. In the same way, if at a certain moment the quantity of a person's pain is so great that no hope, credit, of future pleasure can offer solace, then this must lead to bankruptcy in the business of life. Yet, the number of suicides is still relatively small in proportion to the multitude of those who live bravely on. Only very few people give up the business of life because of the presence of pain. What follows from this? Either it is incorrect to say that the quantity of pain is greater than the quantity of pleasure, or else we simply do not make continuation of life dependent on the quantity of pleasure or pain that we feel. Edward von Hartmann's pessimism is unique in explaining life as worthless because pain predominates, and yet maintaining that we must go through it nonetheless. We must do so because the world purpose mentioned above, page 197, can be achieved only through ceaseless, devoted human labor. But as long as human beings still pursue their egotistical drives, they are unsuited to such selfless labor. They can devote themselves to their true task only if they have convinced themselves, through experience and reason, that the pleasures in life striven for by egotism cannot be attained. In this way, the conviction of pessimism is supposed to be a source of selflessness. An education based on pessimism is supposed to eradicate egotism by presenting it with its own hopelessness. In von Hartmann's view, the striving for pleasure is originally based in human nature. Only insight into the impossibility of fulfillment makes this striving yield to higher tasks for humanity.